Hey, you want that to go?
And now we've got some takeouts on stories that we're following this week. And a big story this morning, especially if you live in Southern California, is the 7.2 magnitude earthquake in northern Mexico. The epicenter was about 110 miles southeast of Tijuana. We're joined now by Susan Hoff. She's a seismologist with the U.S. Geological Survey. Good morning.
Good morning.
Susan, we had a number of Californians posting on our website, and what's interesting is that you can follow the geography up from the Mexican border and see the difference. Sarah is in El Centro. She says it was huge. It started out little and it became huge. Most of the things in our walls fell and crashed. Then we move a little bit further up to Temecula. Then we have somebody saying, my car was swaying and rolling back and forth. Suze in La Jolla says, no biggie, nothing fell. And then Melissa in Santa Monica says, we felt a gentle but unmistakable sway. That's pretty typical of an earthquake, right?
Yes, it is. As you move away from where the earthquake was centered, for the most part, the shaking is going to get a lot less severe.
And how severe was this quake?
Well, if you were right on top of a 7.2, the shaking would have been quite strong. And this was bigger than the earthquake we just saw in Haiti with disastrous consequences. The thing is, this was a fairly remote part of Baja California, which is what's going to keep the damage and loss of life from being larger.
So by the time it got to some of these places like La Jolla, California, or Temecula, California, enough to shake books off your shelf, but not enough to injure someone? Or you can still get injured?
Right. For the most part, we actually have a system on the USGS. It's called colloquially, Did You Feel It? And people come to the website and they fill out a questionnaire to say what they felt. And from that, we can build up a map of the shaking intensity. We've actually had over 70,000 people respond to that. So you can get a sense of what the shaking was like. For the most part in the U.S., there's a few responses from Mexico. So we can see that in the border area, there it was strong enough to knock things off of shelves, as you said. In Brawley, El Centro, directly north, there was light damage. But if people can find the website, they can actually see what happened throughout Southern California.
I texted that exact thing to my sister. She lives in L.A. Did you feel it? She responded, totally not.
So, Susan Hoff, I mean, you at the U.S. Geological Survey, people joke a lot of times about the big one, but you guys are literally expecting a massive earthquake to hit Southern California in some heavily populated areas. Does this give us any idea how well prepared Southern California is?
Yes and no, because it was far removed from where people are living, and it was a 7.2. The quakes that we worry about here are more like 7.5, as large as 8, on the San Andreas Fault or on faults closer to L.A. So really a big part of this story was location, 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 that this just wasn't in a heavily populated area.
Okay, last question for you. Any connection between this earthquake, the one in Chile, the one in Haiti?
You know, I always like to say not that we understand, because that's different from no. I mean, as we understand it, earthquakes just happen randomly, and there is no connection. But there's a lot about earthquakes that we still don't understand.
Susan Hoff is a seismologist with the U.S. Geological Survey.
There's an awful lot about the Supreme Court that we still don't understand and the inner workings of that,
nice.
Celeste. And we're finding out a little bit more because Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens has been giving a rare series of interviews in anticipation of his decision, he says, soon, about whether or not to retire from the court after 35 years. One of those interviews was given to Adam Liptak, Supreme Court correspondent for our partner in the New York Times. Good morning, Adam.
Good morning.
Their speculation is flying in Washington about this.
Well, he does not give a lot of interviews, and in the interviews he has been giving, including to me, he says he's going to make up his mind very, very soon, probably this month, about whether to leave. And I'll tell you that the body language and the signals and some other hints indicate that he's likely to go.
So John Paul Stevens has only hired one clerk. You know, the speculation and the conventional wisdom in Washington is the court term starts in October and the White House would love to have the Supreme Court fight this summer. So it seems like there's some coordination there.
He told me that he wants to give the president and the Senate plenty of time to fill a vacancy. And that's right. If he were to announce in April, we'd follow very much the pattern we had with Justice Sotomayor, which is an announcement a couple weeks, 3 weeks after that, and then maybe confirmation hearings in July, a vote in September, something like that.
Now, we should remind that Justice John Paul Stevens is the vanguard of the liberal wing of the Supreme Court, even though he was appointed by Republican Gerald Ford. So it would make sense that he would want to give President Obama the best footing here, right?
He has certainly told people that whenever he goes, it will be under Obama. So he's going to go in the next couple of years. But again, I think the likely scenario is that he announces very soon, within a matter of weeks.
So how does this work? I know that the separation of powers, the White House and the Supreme Court aren't supposed to communicate and coordinate about stuff like this. But back channel, do you think that somebody says, hey, Mr. Justice, we're not telling you to leave, but if you did, the next 3 weeks would be a spectacular time?
I think it's a little more delicate than that. I think the White House is bracing for, anticipating, making plans, but I don't think it tells Supreme Court justices what to do. I think that kind of communication could well backfire.
Yeah, it could. Well, we got to get to the short list. If there is going to be a Supreme Court nomination this summer, who are some of the names that are coming up to replace John Paul Stevens?
Almost everybody has focused on three names: the current Solicitor General, former Harvard Law School Dean Elena Kagan, a Court of Appeals judge in Chicago, which is, as it happens, Justice Stevens's hometown, named Diane Wood, and a appeals court judge here in Washington named Merrick Garland. All three of them are quite strong candidates.
And quite strong candidates, and the White House might be bracing for a Supreme Court fight this summer in advance of the 2010 elections, which is a great opportunity, I will say, to triangulate your opponents away from somebody who you think is just awfully reasonable for the court. It's going to be an interesting nomination process to watch in the Senate if it happens. Adam Liptak from the New York Times, thanks for joining us.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.